You are listening to the podcast That's Life in Sweden, or as we say in Swedish, Sånt är livet i Sverige, with me, your host, Lisa Orsimäki. In this episode of Sånt är livet i Sverige, or That's Life here in Sweden, I will be talking with Isabella Löfven. She's a former co-leader or co-spokesperson for the Swedish Green Party or Miljöpartiet. She served as a minister for International Development Cooperation. She was the Minister for the Environment and Deputy Prime Minister of Sweden between 2016 and 2021. Hello and welcome, Isabella. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. So to begin this conversation, I'm wondering if you can share about your journey from being a journalist and author, now you were a very successful one at that, to accepting the challenges of sharing the leadership for the Swedish Green Party or Miljöpartiet, as well as the minister post for International Development Cooperation in the Swedish government.
Okay, so it was not kind of development that I would have expected myself. I worked as a journalist for more than 20 years, writing a lot about cultural issues, but also a lot about environment. And then but I always had this nagging feeling, you know, that we are doing something wrong to our planet, and that I want to contribute in the work of trying to set things right. So I wanted always to write about environmental issues. It was a bit difficult to have any editors interested in that. So I wrote a book, it came out in 2007, about overfishing, which was a subject that completely shocked me when I realized how we in Sweden, one of the world's most environmentally conscious and richest countries in the world, with our eyes completely open, just allowed an industry to continue exploiting and overfishing a resource that actually belongs to all of us, all the citizens. And I try to investigate, you know, how is this possible? Why are we not stopping this when we see the effects of it? When we know what happened in Canada and Newfoundland in 1992, when the world's largest cod stock collapsed due to overfishing, we had the warnings, you know. So I wrote this book trying to understand the mechanisms behind it. And the book, a book about overfishing, believe it or not, it became a big success. And I was awarded a number of prizes. And in the end, after debating and writing and speaking about this issue for a year or so, I was recruited and asked by the Swedish Green Party if I wanted to go into the European Parliament, be a candidate there. And after a lot of thinking where my voice would do the most benefit, I just came to the conclusion that if you are so lucky and privileged to live in a democracy, and you are have the opportunity to be part of being a decision maker and trying to change a policy which you see is extremely destructive, then I have to live up to that responsibility as a citizen. So I decided, okay, so I have to say yes to this. And then I was lucky, I was elected to the European Parliament. We reformed the common fisheries policy, which is another story. And then the Swedish Greens came into government, and I was asked to be Minister of Development Cooperation. And after a couple of years, I was also elected the new co-leader of the Swedish Greens and became also the climate minister. And Minister of Environment. So it was quite an unexpected and quite quick journey for me, from being a journalist to being in the end the Deputy Prime Minister of Sweden and leading a government which at the time had the most ambitious climate policy of all countries in the world.
What a journey.
Yeah.
I'm curious to find out. Now, the Swedish Greens Party has a female and a male sharing the leadership role. Why is that? Is that a kind of tradition, or what is it based on?
I think it's based on the fundamental principles and beliefs of the Green Movement that, you know, that power should be shared, and that we should have as representative kind of election procedures as possible. So there's two principles within the Green Party in Sweden. One is that we always have shared leadership, and there should be one male and one female. But the Young Greens, they actually have changed the rules. So now you can have two female leaders, but not two male. Don't ask me why. So we don't have to go into that. But but also the other principle is that you should not remain in one position forever, but after two terms, you should rotate, you should leave. And that's also one of the reasons I left as the leader of the Swedish Greens.
Right. Now, you left politics in 21.
Yes, in the beginning of 21.
Yeah. Mm. So what do you miss from your time as a politician? And what do you remember being the most frustrating aspects of your work and your role, if you like?
Well, I miss being able to actually, execute the change that I see is needed. Mm. Being able to influence the policies that we know are coming now on the table at the European Union, but also internationally, climate negotiations and the national Swedish environmental and climate policies. So even if that's very frustrating to not get, to the 100% of what you want, it's also very rewarding when you get a kind of a policy in place. You manage to have a majority on board. I've been part of, for instance, in negotiations in the European Union where we reformed the European Emission Trading Scheme, which is the most powerful a tool that we have to reduce emissions at the European scale. And we actually did a very ambitious reform where Sweden was very active, and I myself was very active in that. So that was very rewarding. So I can miss that. I can miss the people, very bright, intelligent, and kind of dedicated people that want to make a positive change. Mm. On the other hand, what I don't miss is the polarization, the kind of aggressiveness, the very, very superficial media many times. I don't say that every journalist or every media is superficial, but there's a tendency to not kind of go into depth and trying to understand how policies work or what we're actually doing, but just going into small details where you find some scandalous things, or portraying everything as becoming very corrupt or so on, even if you're trying to do something good, if you see what I mean. So I think one problem, which is a very serious problem today, is that people have very, very low confidence in democracy. Not only in politicians, but also in democracy. That if you ask young people, a majority of them would say that it would be better to have a rule where you only had experts ruling and not elected people. And then you have the feeling that everyone is corrupt. No one is living up to anything. And not least if you see at the young climate movement who are always constantly saying that politicians have failed us. Hmm. But that statement is not correct, because you can't say politicians as if all politicians were the same.
No.
We have parties that are representing very different priorities, very different, let's say, interests behind them.
Hmm.
So if you would have And I'm saying this out loud now because it's true. I mean, if we would have had more than 50% of the votes in Sweden, the Green Party, of course we would have done enough to do what needs to be done to live up to the Paris Agreement. But we're not. We don't have that. So, you know, if you don't have any confidence that it's possible to do change through democracy, through political decisions, then it's extremely serious. And that's also one of the messages of my book, is to point to the fact that we have the tools at hand. I mean, the tools are there in a democracy. We can legislate, we can reform, we can dedicate enough budgets to make a transition possible. It's possible. I mean, look at what the world was able to do during COVID-19, during the pandemic. Through policies, through decisions, you can do the unthinkable. And of course we can address climate change if we just adapt, if we just use the right tools. But if we don't believe in the tools, if we say, okay, so everything is up to some kind of nebulous power somewhere, some companies that need to change or some technology that needs to be developed in the future, we lose the opportunity of doing the change that we can do now. Mm. And that's very much the message of my book.
Yes. Now, you write about the political will being central to turning things around, especially in relation to issues relating to sustainability. And here I'm thinking of Sweden's focus on the international implementation of the 2030 agenda during your time was aimed at equitable and sustainable global development and, of course, climate change. Do you believe our current government here in Sweden possesses the necessary political will to continue following the agenda?
Unfortunately, I must say that the current government seems not to believe in the leadership that Sweden has provided during the last, at least the last 8 years. But I mean, looking retrospective, the Swedish environmental policies have always been kind of more ambitious than the rest of the world. But what we see now was that the climate minister, the current one, she went to the climate meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh with basically two news stories to tell. And one was that Sweden now has new policies that will, consciously, with open eyes, with the estimates of the Swedish ministry, will increase our emissions with at least 10%. New policies in place and not reduce emissions, which is kind of the whole point of the climate meetings, to say that we heightened our ambitions, but we're increasing our emissions. And the second message was that we're decreasing our development cooperation aid. And that is also, you know, quite contrary to what the developing countries, the poor countries want. So and the reason that they do this is because allegedly the Swedish people have such a tough time, and the rest of the world should understand that. And I think that you mentioned sustainable development, you mentioned the Agenda 2030. I'm quite convinced, and also that was a very clear message in Sharm el-Sheikh, the rest of the world does not understand that, does not think that, you know, Swedes in particular have a very, very tough time. We have a war in Ukraine. We have a climate crisis. We have countries that are at the risk of being completely inundated with sea level rise in the Pacific. You know, it's not, we're not suffering if you compare to that, because we have increase in petrol prices and energy prices. We will survive. We have a welfare state here. So this is, I think it's really damaging, because it's also damaging to the kind of moral sense that rich countries are going to do this. Okay, if it's a little bit uncomfortable for us, It doesn't matter because it's the right thing to do. But if we're starting to say, no, it feels a little bit uncomfortable because we have like $1 too high petrol bill, and that's not going to send the right message to, I mean, of seriousness. This is an extremely serious situation that this. The whole of humanity is at this very point in history. That's the truth, you know, and we can't really pretend, I mean, behave like children, basically. I think Greta Thunberg is very right in that analysis that, you know, the children are now behaving like the adults and vice versa. It's not the time to be small and don't have the perspectives of what we're doing and what we need to do. And we need countries that are leaders, and I know that for a fact. On, you know, looking forward, those of us that don't need to be convinced about the climate change is real, or that the extinction rates of species is at a level we haven't seen since the extinction of the dinosaurs. I mean, we don't have time to debate on already established facts on with climate deniers. That's the whole strategy, and that's also something that I go into quite much in depth in my book. The fact that oil companies, fossil fuel companies have financed think tanks to produce these climate denying reports for since over 30 years. And so this is a strategy for them to delay the transition. And I don't think we should waste too much breath on meeting these false accusations. But of course, someone has to do it. But I mean, we're stepping backwards, and I'm extremely worried that we're stepping backward in Sweden, where we right now have one of the most prominent climate deniers being elected to Swedish Parliament, and she's, you know, giving speeches in at the lectern in the Swedish Parliament, which is sent published with the Swedish television in direct for everyone to see. So it's really kind of spreading a new again kind of the doubt about if climate change is real or not. But we don't have time to debate that anymore, I would say. But also when it comes to polarization, it's very clear that that's also a strategy to kind of link the so-called elite, which also includes people that believe in gender equality, who thinks that environment and climate is a priority, and to reduce equality, and all those values actually that we see in the UN Agenda 2030, kind of as a global elite that is trying to to destroy the world. And it's so sad, because I mean, this is the world where we have so much information, but there's also so much disinformation.
You know, thinking about your book, and we go, I've got a couple of questions for it, but the one thing I can say after reading it, it's each chapter provides with great, it provides us with truth and facts. And one of those things that I really caught my attention relate to electric cars.
Yes. That's yeah, and it's fascinating, and it's also very, very depressing, because I think most people would believe that, you know, the reason that we've had all these cars emitting emissions from the combustion engine is because we didn't have an alternative. That was, you know, we hadn't invented the electric car yet, or another type of engine for that case. But, you know, it turns out the electric cars were very much present in the late, in the beginning of the 1900s, and even in the late 1800s. There were more common than the combustion engine, and Henry Ford was planning to produce an electric T Ford. Then the First World War came, and then the oil companies had started to develop, and they had, you know, they wanted to have a market for their produce, and so the car industry made that choice. But you can look at the history of the electric car, and there was some great opportunities in the 1990s, for instance, in California, where the California air legislation, because they had so much smog, they were trying to force the car producers to start producing zero emitting cars. That was actually the very kind of the embryo of Tesla, because what they wanted to do was to have the emission, the combustion engine car producers, to force them to have a quota of zero emitting cars. And if they didn't do that, they had to pay for someone else to do it. And in the end, that was kind of the start of the Tesla success. But already in the 1990s, there were a number of big car producers, General Motors, Mitsubishi, and others. And they developed zero-emitting, totally electric cars. And then they started lobbying the legislators to change the legislation of this kind of mandatory quota. And they succeeded in doing that. And then the manufacturers, they just took back all the cars that they had on the market and destroyed them. And all of this, yeah, and all of this, you can see an excellent documentary called Who Killed the Electric Car? You can find it on YouTube in its totality, 1.5 hours. I really recommend it. And but I don't recommend it to anyone who wants to keep their good temper, because you get so angry when you see it. And it's total, it's one very, very clear example of that it's not technology that is the change maker. It's the policies that is the change maker. And if you change the policies, then the manufacturers, the innovation, the departments of all the industries, they will start solving the problem, and they can do that. Now we see in Sweden, the steel industry, because of the Swedish climate law, has the world's, you know, groundbreaking first technology of producing fossil-free steel. That's because we set a new Swedish climate law, and we started to discuss with the industry how they were going to live up to net zero emissions by 2045. And they realized we have to change our technology. And they already knew that there was alternative technology. But you need to know that, you know, this is it. This is the long-term plan of policymakers, and then they can make the investments. Mm.
So where there is a will, there is a way, but you need to have policymakers on board.
Yes, and you have to also explain to the voters which kind of are going to vote for the different policymakers that it's possible to make the change. Mm. And I think what we live in now is very much a narrative that to make change you need people sacrificing their comfortable lives, and people are not so willing to do that, and that's why we're stuck in the way that we have it. But you can ask anyone who tried an electric car today if they want to go back to a car with a combustion engine, being, you know, totally reliant on buying fuel from Saudi Arabia or Russia. Now, Russia is not there anymore to provide fossil fuel. But I mean, most of the producers are not really very nice democracies. And you have much cheaper and much easier ways of having energy to your car if you have an electric car normally. I mean, of course, you need to have an infrastructure for charging, and that's not everywhere yet. Mm. But once you have that, you see all the advantages of an electric car as compared to one with a combustion engine.
Mm. Now, in your book, this is a brilliant book. I just loved it. And it's called in Swedish, Ocean Känslan. Now, can you, because I know that one of the things that I heard you talk about is that we need to develop a new narrative, or if you like, a new story.
Okay, so the title in English would be the Oceanic Feeling. And it's an expression that I found from an old author, a French author who won the Nobel Prize in literature, Romain Rolland. And what he meant was kind of the feeling when you're kind of full of awe, confronted with nature, when you feel kind of the feeling of sacredness when you're kind of looking out of on the ocean or under the starry sky or up in the mountains, seeing the incredible view, or when you're meeting an animal or even a person, when you feel kind of that sense of meaning and being part of something bigger. So that's the I would say the definition of the oceanic feeling, that you're one part of something much bigger. So the ocean, you're not a drip in the ocean, you're also the ocean in one drop. So it's this kind of, I think most of us can relate to that, you know, that this is fantastic. I mean, it's a miracle that we are here on this living planet, in this enormously big universe where we don't know about any other life, and we see all these beautiful flowers and this, you know, the forest, the smells. I mean, it's incredible that we are here, but we're not treating life or nature as if it had any value at all, except a monetary one. And what I mean is that we need to change our narrative. That is, in order for us to really have kind of the force to take the right decisions, we also need to be very outspoken and give a value to things that are not going to be exploited, but not a monetary one, but rather a moral one, that it's not right to destroy nature, and also that nature has its own inherent rights in a way. We are now in a current kind of logic and narrative, which is one of exploitation, which is one of economic gains, of growth, economic growth, about, you know, getting rich, thinking of yourself. It's a competition, everyone's war against everyone. We have a view of who are we as humans. Yes, we're, you know, if you look down deep down inside, we're very egoistic. We have, you know, this enormous drive to just compete and try to get as much as possible for ourselves. But, you know, this is not true, because most of us, if you kind of see how we behave in daily life, we're quite empathic. We like to kind of do good things. We care. I mean, if you see an animal, let's say you find one on the street that is hurt, you would like to help it. You have empathy for other living beings, not only people. I mean, we can also relate to nature and its, different species in a very, very deep emotional way. Everyone knows that. But still, we can kind of treat animals as just the production entities from a factory when we go into the store. So what I think, I mean, for us, some young people say, and I agree, we don't change the climate, change the system. But I think in order to change the system, we also need to have a really deep look and think about how we think about what is progress, what is happiness, what is welfare, you know, what is it? And I think we have to get rid of our prejudices that welfare and happiness is about exploiting as much as possible, being a winner, but in the same time sacrificing a lot of other people and the planet and animals. So I think we need to start to have this conversation of what is it exactly that we value. And I think looking at ourselves as empathic, creative, caring, and also free people, that could kind of liberate our debate and look at what could be ahead. And it shouldn't be something that is negative for us to do the change, but actually we can live in a much, much better and more sustainable society if we start questioning these values. I think it's been really a tactic from some industries that benefit from the current way that we organize our lives and the market, how it's done. It's been a tactic to kind of take the responsibility off the industries and give it to the individual consumer and say, okay, so we're going to produce premium products here that are environmentally friendly, planet safe, dolphin safe, blah blah blah. But you can also use the other, the kind of basic products that we have that are not environmentally friendly and all of that. But you have to pay a premium for the other things. And then you look at, okay, so it's at the market, and you see, okay, so it's only 20% of the people are willing to pay extra for the environmentally safe things. Conclusion, people don't want change, or people are too, let's say they don't want to spend the extra money on this. So that, here you go. That's why we have the things are like they are. This is a very, very conscious tactic that has been produced by a lot of think tanks for a long time to kind of prevent us from giving the responsibility to policymakers to force the companies to be all products need to be environmentally safe. It shouldn't be allowed, you know, to have fish, for instance, sold at the supermarket that are critically endangered, but still you can find them, and you know, so. And that's because we don't kind of put enough legislation in place to make sure that everything that is on sale is environmentally safe and ethically good in many ways. So I think it's also a tactic that has made people very defensive of environmental policies. Because if you feel that it's all up to you and you understand that, okay, for me to live 100% sustainably, it means I have to sacrifice a lot of things and I don't have the time, I maybe don't have the resources, then you get kind of angry at people that do have the time and the resources, and you think, oh, so they are so elite and they are so moralistic and so on. And I think that's also a reason why there's so much backlash towards the environmental movement. A lot of hate, a lot of talking about double standards, you're hypocrites, blah, blah, blah. And this is not very useful. You know, this is absolutely not useful. So what we need is to realize, and that's also a chapter in my book, that 100 companies, oil, gas, and coal companies, fossil companies, account for 50% of all the carbon emissions that have been done since the beginning of the industrial age. And 100 companies have also produced 70% of all the emissions since 1989. You know, so if you stop looking at the consumer side, if you look at the production side, and you see all the money flowing in there and all the interest there, if you see all the connections between the oil and fossil industry and some governments, some political parties, how they're financing presidents in the United States, etc., how wars have started because of it, you start to understand the bigger picture. And that, you know, if we had set a moratorium on exploration of any fossil fuels 30 years ago, when Margaret Thatcher started talking about a really binding agreement where we need to phase out all fossil fuels very fast, and then you would have forced all these energy companies to start investing in renewables, we would have a completely different world now. If we would have kind of banned combustion engines from cars and gone 100% electric 30 years ago, or even better, 100 years ago, we would have a completely different situation now when it comes to the climate crisis.
In 2017, you provide a fabulous example. You signed a climate bill and you were surrounded by your colleagues, all women. And there was one woman who was pregnant. And I think this related to mocking Trump, who was surrounded by a whole bunch of men in suits signing some kind of bill in the US.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the reason you had these women around you, or is this something that you believe maybe we need more women leaders?
Well, at the time, I think the whole world was quite shocked by all the acts, the legislation that Donald Trump was signing, all surrounded by men. And the first one, actually, it was quite shocking. The first day or so, the first week in office, he signed a bill called the Global Gag Rule, is called generally, which is a rule that prohibits any money from the US to go into any organizations that informs women of sexual reproductive rights and abortions, especially. So, and he signed that all surrounded by men, and a few weeks later, I signed the Swedish climate law, all surrounded by women. And of course, it was a kind of reflection of what he did, because normally I didn't kind of tweet out any signatures of any bills, but in this case, I did.
I think it's just beautiful. I thought that was great, and I thought, oh, I better ask her, what does she think? You know, what was that all about? So, do you think there is an opportunity, maybe you see yourself go back to politics that one day?
At the moment, it's absolutely not in my plans. I think I've done my service for 12 years, and at this moment, I think my contribution to the fight for a more sustainable planet and a more sustainable societies, I can do best by being free and speaking my opinion and not having to battle too much with with political opponents, which is can be very, very tiresome, to put it mildly. So I appreciate and I like, and it's very gives you a lot of satisfaction to make a change with policy, I hope to contribute to making a change in people's way of thinking, and maybe that's an indirect way of influencing.
So will the book be available in English?
I do hope so. For the moment, I don't have any Anglo-Saxon publishing house for the book. But if anyone who hears this is interested, they're very welcome to contact my publisher. And I think we have a translation that I hope will come out very soon.
Fabulous. So is there anything you want to talk about that is important to you and that I have not brought up?
Oh, I think you covered a lot of ground. So it's been really stimulating to talk to you and hear about your questions. I mean, it's we're in a very complex situation in history right now. I'm trying to reflect that in my book. It is, as you said, covers a lot of different topics and trying to kind of understand why we're not doing what we all know that we need to do. Seeing it from a psychological way, from a political, economic, and so on. I don't have anything to add at this moment more than I hope that my book will be available in English for your English speaking audience, that it would be interesting for them to see from a Swedish minister and writer's perspective.
So you don't know really what's next for you apart from maybe doing a bit of touring and talking about the book.
That's right. I'm presently chair of the Swedish Environment Institute board. I'm doing some work for Friends of Ocean Action. I'm also very involved in global ocean issues. So I'm out talking, I'm writing, I think it's quite a good way to kind of start thinking and have some time to be more reflective of what's happening in the world. When you're a decision maker, you don't have so much time to think, which is also, I think, a problem.
Thank you so much, Isabella, for being so generous with your time today. And I hope that you will enjoy a wonderful Christmas and a fabulous New Year 2023 together with your family.
Thank you so much, and the same to you. Thank you for inviting me.
And you have been listening to the podcast Sånt är livet i Sverige, or in English, That's Life, here in Sweden, with me, Lisa Orsimäki. Till next time, take care of yourself and each other. Bye for now.